Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hello, Negotiations Ninja listeners. You've got Mark here from the Negotiations Ninja podcast. We've got our incredible guest on today. His name is John Warrilow. He is the best-selling author of Built to Sell, The Automatic Customer, and The Art of Selling Your Business. Those are three separate books, and they are amazing. He's also the founder of a business called The Value Builder System, and he is the business model expert sought out by the likes of Tim Ferriss and Inc., for his proven methodology in adding millions to the value of a business. Why? Because he knows what to look for and he knows how to look for it. We have a fascinating conversation today. John's also amassed the world's largest library of entrepreneurial exit stories. He's the host of a show called Built to Sell Radio, where he has 300 plus episodes in and ranked by Forbes as one of the world's 10 best podcasts for business owners. Really fascinating conversation with John. Really enjoyed it. And we even talk about my journey as a part of that process. Enjoy. Hello, John. How are you?
I'm great, Mark. How are you?
I am fantastic, my friend. Thank you so much for agreeing to meet me so early and for being here on such short notice. It's very kind of you.
Oh, my pleasure. It's good to be with you. I'm looking forward to talking negotiation stuff.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it as well, man. It's going to be an interesting conversation because your books are so prominent and so well-read and so focused on entrepreneurs and helping them sell their business. And I know there's a lot of lessons in there that we could teach to a lot of people who may not necessarily be entrepreneurs as well. But for the entrepreneurs that are listening right now, or the entrepreneurs, the people who want to be entrepreneurs, John has a series of fantastic books, which we will link to in the show notes. I highly recommend that you pick up, all about focusing on building your business to sell it, and then how to actually sell a business to be profitable and so that you're happy with what happens at the end of the day. But before we get into the topic and the discussion today, John, maybe you could introduce yourself for the listeners. Tell them who you are and what you do.
Yeah, my day job is I run a company called Value Builder, which is practice management software for business advisors. And I kind of moonlight as a writer. So you mentioned a couple of books, Built to Sell being the one that started my kind of journey. And more recently, The Art of Selling Your Business, which is about the final chapter of how do you negotiate the actual exit and feel good about it at the end of running and building a business.
Amazing, man. You, like all Canadians, are very humble. And that introduction was very, very humble for the listeners, just so that you know, very well read author in this space. And I highly recommend that you go and pick up those books. Let's dive into the first topic, John. We talk a lot in entrepreneurship and in negotiation about how egos sometimes play into our ultimate sale of something or whenever we're negotiating something. And something that you talk about is not falling victim to the ego stroke in negotiations. What do you mean by this?
You know, when you build a business, it can be a toiling in darkness for many years, right? You not much acknowledgement from the outside world other than your customers. Unless you're Elon Musk, people don't know about you. And all of a sudden, you get a call from a big Fortune 500 company or a private equity group who wants to buy your company. And it can be intoxicating, right? It's like, wow, somebody has finally acknowledged what I've been building and it's incredible and they love me. And it's actually a trick that is played by acquirers today to use that relatively fragile ego to try to get a proprietary deal, which is when they buy your business without competition. And you know this better than anybody. The competition is what breeds a higher price, breeds better deal terms.
Yes.
And what acquirers do is they go out of their way to try to contact owners before they can proactively put their business on the market. And it's unfortunately one that happens quite naturally. You know, you get kind of wooed into this relationship. They'll say, wow, we love what you're building. Can I buy you lunch? And you go for lunch and they say, you know, it's incredible what you've done. And you're just being showered with all these accolades. And eventually you become sort of, they say, you know, would you mind sharing a little bit more about your company? And then you leave lunch and they say, hey, flip us some financials. I'd love to see, you know, how you're doing, you know, revenue, profitability. And all of a sudden you're like sharing all this information with the other side. And it just puts you in a much, much more reactive position because what happens is that oftentimes acquirers have you sign what's called a letter of intent. And with a letter of intent, it has a no shop clause. And no shop clause is where you cannot negotiate with anybody else. And the moment the no shop clause is signed, the tenor of the relationship changes. You know, the warm accolades and the fuzzy embrace that's coming from the other side stops. And all of a sudden, it goes into another, oftentimes a different group of people on the acquirer's side comes to play. And those folks are analysts trying to pick apart your business so that the other side can retrade. Retrading being lower the price they've agreed to pay you because they found something in due diligence. And it's all a very intentional effort by the other side to get your business for less than it's worth. And so don't fall victim to the ego stroke. It's one of the most common mistakes I think owners make when they go to harvest the value in their business.
As crazy as it may sound, I recently went through this.
You're kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. Where someone, a private equity firm, reached out to me. I own another company, an agency, and they reached out to me and they said, look, we're really interested. We want to have a conversation, blah, 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 the whole thing, right? And I was like, oh, wow, I've only been doing this for like a year, but this is very cool. And you know, my eyes were filled with stars and glitter. But because I'm really busy, right? I run two businesses. I didn't have time, right? And so I couldn't really deal with the stuff. And eventually it just sort of fizzled away and they asked for financials and I sent them a couple of revenue lines and that was basically it. And they were like, look, are you serious about continuing this? I was like, guys, like, not really. You know, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to sell. And a business certainly isn't there yet. And I just don't think I'm ready yet, to be honest. And it just sort of fizzled away and never ended up happening. But I can totally relate with how people would feel in that moment because I felt that way.
Yeah. And here's the thing, when it's really interesting that you've gone through this because private equity companies right now are desperate to deploy capital, right? They've got more money than they know what to do with. Debt is basically free. They can't lose if they buy businesses with debt. That's an overstatement, but it's very hard for them to lose if they're buying businesses with a lot of debt. And so they're after just about any kind of business. Here's the thing that you need to know about private equity groups is that they're kind of like sheep. They virtually have identical investment mandates, right? So what they look for is companies usually in a specific industry. They've got a great niche. They've got management that's willing to stick around. They've got healthy growth and profitability. I mean, like you could read down the investment mandate of basically every private equity group, and maybe with the exception of their industry focus, it's all the same. And so what entrepreneurs, I think, need to know is that if you have been approached proactively by a private equity group, chances are you will be attractive to dozens and dozens of private equity groups. If there's one private equity group doing a roll-up in your industry, chances are there's a dozen. And that's where you get better deal terms and negotiating leverage is bringing multiple players to the table. But what we usually do is we get fallen in love with the one people who had kind of acknowledged us the first time. And we go down this route of sort of being susceptible to this ego stroke and signing a no shop clause. And then all the negotiation leverage is lost. So again, if you get approached by a private equity group, assume that there's another 10 or 12 out there that would also want to buy your business. And your job, I think, as an entrepreneur is to bring those people to the table.
Yeah, love that. There's a term there that I don't know that a lot of people might understand, but you spoke about having a roll up. Could you define that for people?
Yeah, it's when a private equity group, usually by a private equity group, would buy multiple businesses in the same industry and take advantage of the synergies associated with that. So for example, there's a number of groups doing a roll up in dental practices. So when you buy dental practices, if you buy enough of them, you can eliminate some of the back office people. So there's efficiencies there.
You also get the scale of purchasing and all that.
That's exactly right. And you get more purchasing power, right? So when you go to buy light fixtures for your dental chairs, instead of buying one and getting the retail price, you're buying 1,000 and getting a much, much deeper discount. And so there's lots of synergies that you get from scale. And so those private equity groups benefit. First of all, they're using a lot of debt when they buy those companies. So they're not putting a lot of equity in the business. They usually make you, the owner, carry some equity, oftentimes 30, 40%. So they kind of lock you in to stay for the next kind of round. And then again, they take advantage of some of these synergies associated with buying power and so forth. And sometimes they've got also entrepreneurial or management chops that they bring some practices to the table that make the business more profitable. And their pitch is, look, you're going to benefit because not only are we going to give you some money for your 60% right now, years down the road, we're going to sell the whole thing, the rolled up thing. And that 40% of your equity is going to become worth more. It does happen that way. It can happen. It can also happen that the 40% goes to zero. I interviewed on Built to Sell Radio a guy named Ryan who built a company and an Amazon reseller, got $18 million of revenue, sold it to a private equity group, sold 60%, carried 40. The private equity group unfortunately, levered up the business, meaning they took on a lot of debt. They brought in another manager who didn't really know what they were doing. And ultimately, the business started to fail, couldn't pay off the debt. And the 40% that he left in the company went to zero. So that's Ryan Moran. And his story is a cautionary tale about selling to a private equity group.
Yeah. It's a similar story that I had a conversation with a lady named Victoria Pinchon the other day. She's a negotiation author and she's done a number of things, but she consults a lot of people moving from corporate to startups and how a lot of startups will convince corporate executives from sort of Fortune 500 companies to come join the startup to add to the bench strength of the organization. And the attractiveness of a lot of the offer is around RSUs and all that kind of stuff. And you know, she said, well, the risk is that the startup goes to zero and your RSUs are worth nothing at the end or whatever it might be. And it's a difficult challenge a lot of the time. And she talked about like how to negotiate your way into a decent deal, at least, like because there is an attraction, obviously, to go into a startup. And people, a lot of people should do that, especially if they're sort of mid-career and they're looking for a change and they want to hit that C-level. Mm-hmm. So making that change can sometimes be a very good thing for them, but making sure that you get the right deal there is very unique. And something that you talk about as well is, you know, if you get into a position where you are going to sell your business, the key is to start building a business that's worth selling.
Yes.
So that you have leverage in the negotiation. What do you mean by building a business that's worth selling? Because my natural next question would be, well, isn't every business worth selling?
Maybe every business would like to be sold, but actually very few are. Here's the challenge. Most businesses start off because the entrepreneur, the founder has some sort of technical expertise that they sell. And that business then becomes really deeply dependent on the owner. And if you've got a business that is dependent on the owner, it's actually not worth very much to anybody else. Because literally, when you write the check to the owner, all of the sort of essence of the business, the customer relationships leaves. And so what I think the job of the entrepreneur is to structure their business so that it can thrive without them, so they can succeed without the owner doing the work. And I think that's the ultimate poker hand. If you've got a business that can really successfully thrive without you, number one, it's not going to stress you out. And the key to any great negotiation is the willingness to walk away. Again, I don't mean to preach to the choir, but obviously, you know that if you're willing to walk away in a negotiation, that's the ultimate ace up your sleeve. So that's number one. Number two, it allows you flexibility to bring in a manager to run your business day to day. You could also sell to a private equity group and keep a tranche of equity if you wanted to and create some wealth for you, liquid wealth for you on the other side. You could sell all of it. You can kind of just cherry pick the projects you want to get involved in and have a chief operating officer or a general manager kind of run the business day to day. All those options are available. And here's the thing. I think for a lot of owners, we confuse the role of entrepreneurship to being growing our top line revenue. If you look at any list of the most successful entrepreneurs, it will be determined by top line revenue growth, right? So the Inc. 5,000 fastest growing companies in the United States, it's just the fastest top line revenue companies. And I think what that does, and the media covers these stories, and what it does is leaves us with this sense of that top line revenue is the most important metric to hit. And for most entrepreneurs, I actually think they would be better served changing their headspace from thinking of their role from the CEO of their business or the chief revenue officer of their business in many cases, to their business's parent. It's a weird analogy. Let me try to dig underneath that for you. When you think about the role of a parent, and I'm not sure if you're a parent, Mark, but I'm a parent and I think about my own kids. They're going through their teenage years, right? And my wife in a joke, like, we don't want them. They don't necessarily have to go to Harvard or be the quarterback on the, you know, college football team. But if they get to a point where they're happy functioning adults in the world, independent of us, like we've done our job. That's a tick box, right? Where they're successful and they can kind of live their lives on their own terms. And I think for a lot of owners, we would be better served thinking of our role as that of our businesses, kind of like being the parent of our business, right? And thinking that you go through the adolescent years where they may be going off in the wrong direction, but your job is to cajole it back so it can succeed without you. And I think if we think about that sort of framing, as opposed to just growing top line revenue growth, because we think that's going to make us important in the world, I think that changes the decision making that we would take and some of the things that we would do differently in that case.
Hey Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started, and you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. Something that you speak about in your new book, by the way, for the listeners, just an important note, there's a new book that John's written called The Art of Selling Your Business, which is brilliant, and I recommend that you pick it up. Something that you talk about is building to sell it is great, but then you've got to find someone who would be sort of the natural acquirer, right? Who would be the best fit for buying your business. What do you mean by that, and how do we go about that process?
Yeah, three types of buyers. So individual investors really buy small businesses, less than a million or two in revenue, and they're really buying a job, right? We've already talked about the second type of buyer, which is a private equity group. Oftentimes, they're going to ask you to roll some equity in. They generally don't pay as much for the business because they've got to see a return on investment. And then there's the strategic acquirer. The strategic acquirer is the natural acquirer where generally they're going to pay the most for your business because they've got some strategic asset making your business worth more in their hands than it is in your hands. I'll give you an example because I think it sort of illuminates it better. One of the people I interviewed on Built to Sell Radio is a woman named Stephanie Breedlove. She built a great business. She did payroll for parents who have a nanny to pay, right? So business came about because she called ADP because she wanted to set up payroll for her own nanny. And they kind of bounced her call around 10 different departments thinking like some lady on the phone wants to set up payroll for her nanny. And like nobody knew how to do it. So she said, why don't we create a payroll company just for parents who have a nanny to pay? And she built it up at the time.
Good idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And over 25 years, she built it up to $9 million in revenue. So like, this is not, you know, Tesla. This is not Google. This is an ordinary business that grew steadily over a 25-year run. She got $9 million in revenue, 10,000 customers. And she decided she wanted to exit. And she looked out in the marketplace to try to find who would have the strategic reason to buy my business. Who would have a what they call investment thesis, right? Who is the strategic? And she discovered Care.com. If you don't know them, they're like the Angie's List of babysitters, right? Like you plug in your postal code or your zip code, and it will give you a list of 5-star rated babysitters in your local market. Cool service, right? As a new parent, you want to trust your kid with someone who's been 5-star rated. And at the time of the acquisition, Care.com had 7 million subscribers. So think about that. It's 7 million parents who have a nanny or a babysitter to pay. So Stephanie went to them and said, look, guys, if 1% of your 7 million subscribers buy my payroll service, that's 70,000 customers. Did I tell you I'm 9 million in revenue on just 10,000 customers, right? So 1%. And they gave her an offer for a $9 million revenue company of $40 million. That's unbelievable, right? Like, what is it? More than 4 times top line revenue. Breedlove goes back and says, not enough. She says, you're missing the opportunity. If 1% at 70,000 customers, now imagine 2% of your 7 million subscribers buy my payroll service. Now we're talking a company of 14 times the size of my business. Anyways, long story short, she sells us for $54 million. 6 times top line revenue. Like, it's an unbelievable outcome. But again, she found a strategic, someone who had an investment thesis to buy the business. So it was worth a whole lot more to Care.com than it was to Stephanie Breedlove. And she negotiated hard. She made the case economically that what she had built was worth a truckload to them.
I love that. What a great story. I'm always reticent to timestamp a podcast, but I think this is an important question given the time that we're in and given the way that we see private equity moving a lot right now. So for the listeners, just so that you know, we're beginning of August when we're chatting with John here. You're probably listening to this somewhere in mid-September, but there is a lot of private equity flowing around right now. And I am seeing some valuations of some companies in my sphere of people that I know that are getting insane valuations when they're going to Series A, Series B, like ridiculous valuations. Is that just a sign of the times, or is that, are we reaching sort of the tipping point of, or maybe the popping point, I should say, of a bubble? Like, where do you think we're at?
An old friend of mine, we used to joke about multiples, and his refrain or response was always multiple of what? And we talk about multiple profit, like what's multiple profit? Okay, well, that's great. So is that multiple of last year's profit, a weighted average of 3 years ago? Is it next year's forward-looking profit? Is it et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And I think it's worth knowing what we are multiplying before we sort of compare fishing stories about the size of the outcome, et cetera. Yeah, I think right now we are at an interesting moment of time. We're hopefully coming through the back end of this pandemic, knock wood, and a lot of owners have just been beaten down, crushed by this, especially service business owners, but it's been a difficult road. Even for folks who have succeeded through this process, it's been stressful. And that is meeting a group of private equity groups that are fueled by cheap debt. Again, remember, private equity groups, they get a return on their investment by buying businesses with very little equity. They do it with a lot of debt. And that's what their model is contingent on. So
and
right now,
we're so cheap these days.
Right. Emergency level interest rates. We've got very low debt. And, you know, I'm reminded of Rand Fishkin. Have you ever had Rand on the show?
I haven't. Not yet. Yeah. He's the guy from.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I just think it's an important story to share with your listeners. I had him on Built to Sell Radio. He's written a great book called Lost and Founder. But I talked to him about his business, Moz, because he went through a process where he almost sold it. And he was approached by Brian Halligan from HubSpot, co-founder of HubSpot, and they offered him $25 million for a $5 million business, which again, he's in the software space, SaaS, so they get high valuations, but still $25 million for a $5 million business is a pretty good outcome. And Rand had heard that it might be worth more like four times top line revenue. And they were going from where they were at five, they were expecting to be at 10 by the end of next year. So he's four times 10 is 40. And they're only offering me 25. And so he said no. And instead, he raised some venture capital. And the way VCs invest is they typically invest with preferred shares, guaranteeing them a preferred return. And that's an important part of the story because as the Rand started to spend the VC's money, he started to bleed cash. They were going in all sorts of different product lines that they didn't really understand. The VC started to get nervous and they removed Rand as the CEO of the company. And I interviewed Rand after the fact and I said, well, at least you still got your Moz stock, right? I mean, that must be worth a truckload. And he said, no, actually, John, I don't think it's worth anything. And I said, what do you mean it's not worth anything? He said, well, because of the way the VCs invest, getting a preferred return and the length of time they've held, my common stock is probably worthless at this point. And I said, Rand, what would that offer from Halligan be worth today? Because it was cash and HubSpot stock and HubSpot stock's gone up a ton. He said, John, it'd be worth close to $200 million.
Oh.
And I share that story with you, Mark, because it goes to the point about timing, right? Like right now we're talking about, you know, is this the right time? Private equity groups are offering these great multiples and blah, 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 blah. And I think as entrepreneurs, we're optimistic, right? We're always thinking about tomorrow's going to be better than today. And if I can get six times today, I'm going to be able to get seven times tomorrow. And we're just really hardwired for optimism. And then you learn about a story like Rand, and it just kind of hits you with a 2x4 between the eyes. Like, you know, the best time to sell your business, frankly, is when someone's buying. And when you get a call from a Brian Halligan, I'm not saying you drop your pants and just, you know, you fall into the arms of Brian Halligan and agree to sell to him. I'm saying that when you get an unsolicited offer, know that there are probably other acquirers out there in the same industry that would be equally interested. And now may be the right time. And I think that's a really important lesson. It's, I think we're hardwired for optimism. But you never know when the right time to exit is. And when you get approached, I think it's an important, serious conversation to have with yourself.
Yeah. Something that you talk about is valuing your business, because sometimes we try and value it objectively, but we have so much subjective stuff that goes on. You kind of lean into that a little bit with that story. Part of it is being happy with what you're getting out of it, right? Or being happy with at least the approach that you take, because you don't want to end up like Iran just being like, I'm pissed about that. Hindsight's always 20/20, granted. Okay, fair enough. But what are some of the things that you think people should consider to be happy with what they get out of it.
Yeah, we've actually done a bunch of research into this at Value Builder. What we've learned is that the happiest entrepreneurs are ones that have more pull factors than push factors. What do I mean by that? Pull factors are things you're excited to go do. You write a book, get fit, run a marathon, travel, whatever. Push factors are the things that frustrate you about your business. You have government regulation, employees, angry customers, et cetera. Those are all push factors. We all have push factors, right? But the secret, I think, to a happy exit is to really ensure that your pull factors outweigh your push. I'm reminded of another guy I interviewed on Built a Radio, a guy named Sean Oshman. And he had a great little IT business, nothing too extraordinary. I think it was a couple million bucks in revenue, you know, 10% profit margins. He wakes up on his 39th birthday and he says, I'm sick of living in landlocked Denver. I want to live on a sailboat. Kind of a weird thing for a guy in Denver to think, right? He decides he wants to live in a sailboat. And so he says, by my 40th birthday, I'm going to live on a sailboat. So he goes out and hires a broker to sell his company for him. The broker comes back with an offer of 2.5 times profit. Not a huge offer, right? But, you know, fine. He accepts the offer, buys his boat. And I interviewed him after the fact. I said, you know, Sean, 2.5 times earnings, it's like, it's okay. But, yeah, you know, you could have stuck, you could have stuck around for a couple of years and put all that profit in your jeans and still owned your business, right? I mean, like, are you sure you're happy with your exit kind of idea? And he said, yeah, John, I don't think you understand. And I'm like, what don't I understand? He said, I'm on a sailboat right now. And he described the fact that he achieved his goal, right? Like he was living on a sailboat. And that's, I think, that the secret, one of the secrets, I think, to not necessarily being disappointed with your exit is being more pull and push, having something you're excited to go do. And I think that's really important. Again, I know that's kind of kumbaya, kind of warm and fuzzy stuff, especially coming from a guy who talks about negotiation.
It matters though, right? Like, I mean, it's almost like the Tim Ferriss story in the 4-Hour Workweek where he tried to automate things so that he could go and do the tango thing and could go, you know, do the push hands thing that he did a competition in. That's the kind of stuff that matters. You got to think about, why am I actually doing this, right? Like, what is the point?
Yeah. And I think, you bring up Tim. I've had a chance to speak with Tim about the exit from his Brain Quicken, which was the supplements business he sold in order to get him into the writing business. And we talked about the exit. And one of the things that was fascinating was he was insistent on not having an earnout. And an earnout, for folks who don't know, is basically where you agree to sell your business, you get some money up front usually, but then you get a second or third tranche of money if you achieve a certain set of goals in the future as a division of the acquiring company. And they're fraught with problems, right? You know, as an entrepreneurial leader, you're probably not used to having a boss. The other side can also graft expenses onto your profit and loss statement unilaterally. They often take over billing and you kind of back office finance. So you don't even know sometimes how your business is doing. So it's just a disaster in many cases waiting to happen. There are good examples of earnouts that worked out for the owner, but I think many more that don't. I interviewed a woman named Jody Cook about a month ago. She had a great business in the UK where they did social media. And Jody was insistent that she not have an earnout. And marketing services companies are almost always sold with an earnout, right? Because the people are the most important assets, et cetera. And so her first offer was, you know, 80% upfront, 20% earnout. And she said, no, you're not getting it. I don't want an earnout. I'm not agreeing to it. She's a super independent woman. And so she went out and created all of her processes into standard operating procedures, SOPs, where she kind of painstakingly went through documenting the way they kind of ran the business. And ultimately, she was able to sell the business without an earnout because she had those SOPs. And I asked her, I said, Jody, that must have been like painstaking work for you as like an independent entrepreneurial leader, like actually sitting down and writing out your processes must have been like crushing for your soul. And she said, yeah, but you know, I thought about it. Would I rather live 3 months in jail or 3 years in jail? Like if you had to go to prison, would you rather do it for 3 months or 3 years? And she was making the point that if I didn't do the work to create the standard operating procedures, I would have had to succumb to an earnout, right? And then I'm in jail working for some schmuck for 3 years. This way I take my medicine up front. Anyways, it's all kind of part of this whole notion of avoiding an earnout and the importance of that for a lot of entrepreneurs.
John, as we wrap up, I'd like to leave the listeners with sort of one big tip when you want to leave them with thinking about selling a business. If you were going to leave them with one thing to think about, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a piece of tactical advice, but just maybe something to think about strategically when it comes to selling the business, what would you have them think about?
I'd have them think about something called the freedom point. The freedom point is when the sale of your company would create enough liquid wealth for you to live comfortably for the rest of your life. And when you crest that point where, again, the after-tax proceeds of selling your company would create enough liquid wealth that you could live for the rest of your life, I would ask yourself the question, am I willing to continue to grow this business when growing it, especially when it's a large portion of your net worth, essentially risks what you might have started your business. For most entrepreneurs I talk to, their greatest aspiration is freedom, right? It's not to become the next Elon Musk, although some people want to be that. Most people really desperately crave freedom, the ability to do what you want when you want to. And I think it was Warren Buffett who said, it's the definition of insanity to risk what you want for something you don't. And if your goal is freedom, if that's why you started your business, and you've crested the freedom point where creating enough, you know, selling would create liquid wealth to enable you to be really, truly free, are you willing to, like a blackjack player at the tables, kind of risk that every day? Because as we've come through this pandemic, I mean, go back 2 years ago, for a lot of people, they had no clue what was about to happen, right? And if they could wind back the clock and sell in 2019, I think many people would take that bet, right? Rather than going through the last couple of years. And so I would encourage people as they go about their lives and their business, when you crest the freedom point, it's just worth proactively, consciously making that trade and saying, yep, I'm willing to make that trade to get to the next tranche, the next revenue, you know, band or whatever, or I've achieved it. I've done what I wanted to do. And if I sell, I've got enough liquid wealth to have that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I'm above the one where I'm worried about where my next meal is coming from. And I think that's just a really important thing to keep in mind.
I think that's really good advice. The risk of continuing risks what you built the business for in the first place.
Especially when it's a huge part of your net worth, which it is for many owners.
Yeah, yeah. For most people, it makes up the majority of their net worth. I love that.
And we would diversify all day long in our 401k or our investments, right? Yeah. We would never have more than 5% or 10% in one stock. That's the height of insanity. Yeah. Yet for most entrepreneurs, they have 50, 60, 70, 80% of their net worth in their privately held business. And it would just never happen in real life or in a publicly traded stock portfolio. But we kind of unconsciously, in many cases, just keep it all rolled into that. So I don't mean to get on my high horse, but that's one thing I would just encourage people to kind of think about.
But it's really smart, right? I mean, a lot of people have stars in their eyes about being sort of like the next Elon Musk or whatever it is, or the next big thing. But I've listened to Elon Musk talk about his workday, and it does not sound attractive to me.
It
sounds terrible. It sounds horrific. The guy's sleeping in the factory on a consistent basis, like almost 100% of the time, never sees his family, right?
Like five kids.
Sounds horrific.
Not for me.
Yeah.
Not for me.
Well, amazing advice, John. A pleasure to have you on. Really great insight and love these books. Amazing, amazing work. For the listeners, just so that you know, the two main books that we spoke about today are called Built to Sell and The Art of Selling Your Business. And John, if listeners want to pick up these books and your other business books, the other one I think is called The Automatic Customer. Where do they go to find those?
Yeah, I mean, the best place to go is builttosell.com. And we've actually put together a page, builttosell.com/ninja. Where we've uploaded The Art of Selling Your Business workbook, which is kind of like a sister book or a companion book to the book you can get on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. And it's really a workbook that is designed to help you apply what's in the book to your own business. It's a bunch of questions you can ask yourself to get yourself ready for the exit. So it's just builttosell.com/ninja. It's free. So you can download the workbook. It's there for you.
What a great CTA and what great attribution. For the listeners, just so that you know, I highly recommend that you go to that page, builttosell.com/ninja. I'm on it right now. I'm looking at it. There's a lot of free gifts there that are available to you. 8 Key Drivers video series, the 9 subscription models ebook, The Art of Selling Your Business workbook. Brilliant stuff. John, thank you so much for being on.
Cool, man. It was fun to be with you.
Hey, friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.